Well, you're listening to Live from Godfrey Daniels. This is WDIY. I am Dina Hall, and it's a pleasure to be here again on a Tuesday night, as we always do. Tonight in the studio, I have with me a very good friend of mine, and I hope some of yours as well. Ramin Shay again is here with me, and why don't you say hi?
Hey, Dina, how's it going?
It's going really well, and we are going to talk a little bit tonight. We're going to play some music. We're going to tell tales, hopefully not too tall.
taller than a Sitka spruce.
Okay. Okay. Well, why don't you just, we'll start off by telling the folks a little bit. You are known I know you as a incredibly talented and hardworking. I could go on with all of the adjectives, but you are a musician, you're a songwriter, you are a guitarist, you sing, you play what else?
Lately I've begun to study and play the mandolin, not quite as intensely or seriously as I wish I had time to do, but it's a lot of fun for sure, and it takes you sort of out of your comfort zone, so I'm definitely enjoying that.
I've watched that, yeah. So, all right. So we're going to explore some of that in the conversation today. Part of your... The daily ongoings of your life. Why don't you tell us a little bit? How was your day? How was your work day?
Today was good. So I work at the Martin Guitar Company, which is right here in the Lehigh Valley in Nazareth. And I always get a kick out of it driving from Nazareth to Bethlehem, just the sort of biblical names, especially this time of year. But so the Martin Guitar Company's been around for a very long time, since 1833. They're the oldest and the biggest guitar maker around, and so that's my job. I design new models. I work to develop concepts into instruments and to test materials. So at this point, we're rapidly approaching a trade show, which is called the NAMM Show. Mm-hmm. It's the National Association of Music Manufacturers. And it is just like carnival-esque. Everybody from guitar effects pedals to keyboards to zithers kazoos, like the best kazoos that money can buy. Everybody is there displaying their newest, latest, and greatest innovation. And so Martin is certainly a part of that. So it's a little bit stressful this time of year as we get up to the product launches, but I'm really excited.
Fabulous. Where does that take place?
That's in Anaheim, California.
That's what I thought. Yeah. Okay. I've seen some pictures on Instagram of the signage outside the building.
Oh, it's incredible. We reconstruct almost a mock-up of the factory out there, and people can you sort of have the brick walls, and it's almost like you're looking in the window of the factory.
Wow.
I mean, it's huge. The square footage of this convention center is just unreal.
So when you're... you're speccing, is that what we're doing? You're specifying the products that are going to be made, or are you testing them?
Yes, all of the above. A lot of my job consists of making sure that things work, for production and for, more importantly, for the player. So it's sort of a compromise between, trying to make life easy for ourselves and trying to make life easy for guitarists, and trying to figure out how we can best satisfy, at least in my position, best satisfy the players, particularly players who don't have a ton of money to spend on a guitar. That's really important to
money. Yes. Yeah. So does there come a point where you say you have to meet a price point with certain components of the guitar?
Well, certainly, we want to make sure that we're making the best instruments that we can, and quality costs. But all of which to say, I think, my goal, especially in designing instruments for the sort of lower end consumer, the person who maybe doesn't have $3,000 or $4,000 to spend on a guitar, is just to make sure that if you go into a store and you've got $700 and you're looking for a really good instrument, that if you reach for the Martin in that price point, that sort of category, that instrument is going to be every bit a contender for the best in class. And that's what we strive for.
So what guitar do you have with you tonight?
Oh, well, it's kind of a funny story. So I have a terrible affliction of guitar buying. They call it gas. They say you've got gas, which is guitar acquisition syndrome. This will be familiar to probably any musicians out there, that sort of gear kind of propagates and multiplies, and you start with one guitar in your closet, and the next thing you know, they've got little baby mandolins floating around in there. So this is an HD28. It's a herringbone dreadnought, sort of a flagship model. I just got it back from my mother, who started taking guitar lessons recently, about a year and a half ago. She's really good. But she came to visit, and we were sort of going through the cases that you have to move out of the way to get through the door. And she said, "Oh, Ramin, what is this?" And of course, has pulled out a 1930 Martin size 2. So it's a genuine pre-war Martin guitar, just beautiful little thing. Oh. And she fell in love with it. She said, "Oh, can I have it?" I said, "Yes." So I gave that to her for Christmas, and in return have got my HD28, which was the loaner guitar, back. So,
oh,
yes. So this is like a new old friend here.
You're a good son. Yeah. Why don't you play something on that for us? It'd be really cool if we could maybe a new song, or what would you like to play?
Well, let's see. So I tend to drive a lot of inspiration from nature and from animals and from weather phenomena. So this is a song about a horse who has maybe had it with his life as a horse, and in spite of the fact that he's very tired, can just only think of ways to continue being useful. The song is called "The Old Tool Shed."
All right, I'm going to remind everyone, this is live from Godfrey Daniels. This is WDIY Allentown.
I pulled your tiller and I pulled your plow and I towed your freight down the Erie Canal, but I don't want to work no more. So you can take me out back behind the old tool shed and put the 44-40 to my head, 'cause I don't want to work no more. I'm going to the land of the apples, where the corn and the sweet grass are high. I'm going to the land of my fathers, where the old ponies go when they die. Send me off to the glue factory and I'd join your timbers for eternity, but I don't want to work no more. And you could send my leather to the tannery, you could make a horsehide coat from me, but let me ride on a motorcycle breeze, 'cause I don't want to work no more. I'm going to the land of the apples, where the corn and the sweet grass are high. I'm going to the land of my fathers, where the old ponies go when they die. I towed your freight down the Erie Canal, but I don't want to work no more. So you can take me out back behind the old tool shed.
Bye. thunderous applause. Yes. I've heard that one a number of times. I always like that. And I want to ask you, how far back in your life, in your relatively young life, does guitar playing, how did you get started playing and really developing zest?
Well, it's funny. I kind of took to it like a fish to water. But basically, when I was growing up, it was sort of this era where the internet was not in every home, so to speak. So we did have the internet, but we didn't have video games. My parents sort of were not into that, and I'm so grateful now in retrospect that all that time that I could have spent doing other things, instead I spent listening to my uncle's old Led Zeppelin albums. So I didn't inherit them because my uncles are all alive. But
someday,
I was sort of given a custody of all of these great classic vinyl albums, and had the world's most awful portable record player. And so I remember when I got my first guitar, I was probably 13 years old, and it was a Squire Strat Pack. You know, it was $190 for a guitar, plus amplifier, plus cable, and a set of strings, and it was like, all right, you want to try this out, see if you like it. And man, did I ever. So basically, I learned to play guitar by... listening to these albums, and I'd start, you know, with the Zeppelin cranked real loud and the guitar amplifier really soft, and then over time, over the course of, you know, a couple of years, slowly turn the amp up and turn the record player down until you sort of get to know all the parts. Man, it was a lot of fun, and it's still a lot of fun.
So you build electric guitars as well.
I do. I build electric guitars mostly for my own usage and enjoyment, but, you know, have built several that, you know, are out in the hands of other musicians, which I really is very fulfilling. So I guess early on, I kind of realized that I didn't like that Squire Stratocaster all that much, and I really loved the way the neck felt, but I did not like the way that the electronics were and that the body was. And so I decided I would build myself one from a kit and asked my dad to help me with that. I remember taking a hacksaw, and he and I, cut the peg head shape out and put the thing together and tried our best to solder it correctly. My dad is an electrical engineer, so it's sort of like had a really big leg up there as far as what we had at home to do this. In the end, that guitar, really, I didn't love it either. And so, just that being dissatisfied, I thought to myself, God, I love the electronics on this one. I love the shape of it. And I just dislike the neck. And this other guitar, I really like the neck. Being somewhat resourceful, I thought I'll just stick them both together, and realize that you can't actually do that. It doesn't work. There are different scale lengths, and manufacturer specifications are not the same from model to model. And so at that point, I realized that there was a lot more going on that I just didn't know, and sort of struck out to learn this stuff.
So you set out on this path to learn how to build them.
Yes.
This is your... path toward becoming a luthier.
Yeah, and yeah. So, a Lucifer.
A luthier. And so you, did you study from a very young age? Did you travel? Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So the first guitar I slapped together age 14 or 15. And then a few summers later, when I was 16, I was in Germany with my family. We would go for 6 months, 7 months at a time, sometimes 3 or 4 months at a time. And this one summer, I asked my parents if I could do this guitar making course with a luthier in Hanover. His name's Thomas Stratmann, and he makes just beautiful, beautiful instruments. And that was sort of the first time I tried to design one, and build it from scratch. And I think at the time, I think I was the youngest person who had done the course. But now, I sort of stay in touch with Tomas on the internet, which is great. And there are like really talented kids that are, you know, even younger than I was, who clearly are have like deep passion. So I have a lot of faith that that innovation is going to just continue to explode in the world of guitars. Creativity is really there. After building that guitar, I went back, finished high school, and went to college, and ended up taking a semester off to go learn guitar making more in depth from Brian Gallup, who runs the Gallup School of Luthery in Michigan, and spent almost 7 months living there in a residential program, just building guitars all day long, doing repair work, finishing. History lessons, guest lectures coming in. It was really incredible, and that sort of set me on a path of realizing that it is possible to do this for a living, which is a crazy thing. It's crazy to think that you can make a living just building guitars.
So not as crazy as thinking that you could make a living playing the guitar.
Well, yeah,
building. Yes.
Well, that's a tangible, there's some tangible right. output
right.
there.
Yeah. Guitars break, people need them repaired, people need new ones.
Exactly, yes. Exactly. And I think probably most independent luthiers, the repair work is their bread and butter, more than building.
Mm-hmm.
That certainly is the dream for a lot of people. But, you know, everybody at some point will encounter a problem with an instrument. They're finicky, temperamental things, especially this time of year. It's like, you know, the humidity and the temperature changes. But repair work is really challenging and fun as well. So that's kind of a good way to supplement your income.
Yeah, I can tell you, I had I was here for doing an interview probably 7-8 years ago in this exact studio, and my friend who was here with me bumped my guitar and it fell over and right here cracked the headstock.
Oh.
And it was glued, and several years later I dropped it again and that crack got worse and it was glued again. But you know what, it's my favorite guitar. You've played my Alvarez guitar.
Oh, absolutely.
It's beautiful, but it's been repaired twice. But those repairs are worthwhile.
Oh, it's funny, Dina. Now I feel like this studio ought to have like a chalk outline of a guitar on. This is like a murder scene. You
I
know?
Can tell you where. All right. Yes, hold on to your guitar and don't let go. So how did this path of learning, studying luthier, get you to your job right now where you are at Martin?
That's a crazy story. So the stars aligned in a few different ways. I had applied for a job at Martin several years before I actually ended up getting hired there, and I met the great, incomparable sort of ambassador for all of us at Martin, Dick Boak.
Mm-hmm.
who has just been such a kind mentor and extremely generous with his time to me. But at the time I met him, you know, we didn't know each other at all, and I sort of cheekily showed up in the lobby with a guitar that I had built and was sitting there playing it, you know, hoping that someone would come down and talk to me, and they sent Mr. Boak, and I remember very clearly he said, well, look, you can apply for a job, but they are going to drug test you. And I had long hair at the time. I'm like, well, you know, what is that supposed to mean? And I ended up moving back to Carlisle, Pennsylvania to go study violin making.
Was because of the drug test?
No. it seemed like the right place at the time. And so I apprenticed to a violin maker there in Boiling Springs for 3 years.
Yeah.
And guitars are way more fun than violins, so definitely. Over the course of the 3 years there, I realized I really was just using the space to build guitars, and much to the disappointment of my extremely patient violin master teacher.
Can you play the violin?
Oh, so badly.
Okay.
Oh, it's really
that's about all I've expected. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's like strangling a cat.
Okay.
I did then reapply for a job at Martin, and I didn't hear anything back, and Was sort of shopping around, hoping that I could find some kind of gig in guitar manufacturing. And so I went out to Washington State and did a stint there with a company called Warmoth that makes beautiful, beautiful custom guitar necks and bodies. But they sort of nary shall the two meet in there. They don't assemble them. So it's like you can buy a neck or you can buy a body, but you can't. They will not put them together for you. But they made me a job offer, and I came back and I thought, man, do I really want to move all the way across the country? But I felt like I didn't really have any other options at the time. So I picked up the phone to call them and accept the offer. And as I was dialing the number, I got a call from the HR department at Martin that said, hey, we've got your application here. Are you still interested in a job? And I couldn't say yes fast enough. I ended up taking a job as a finish sander on the production line, did that for a year, and then ended up sort of landing my dream job, really. I feel like it's just been a hugely generous opportunity for me, and I really love it.
Yeah, yeah. I've seen the lovely little space that you work from. It looks like I would enjoy that.
I feel like this is a really appropriate moment to give a shout out to the person I probably work with in the closest proximity on a day-to-day basis, my friend Justin Perrine, who's an extremely talented guitar maker and woodworker in general. But I am so scatterbrained and, tend to leave such a colossal mess in our little workspace. I come in sometimes and I realize that, like, things are back where they belong.
Oh,
and then
yeah.
I can find that tool that I had in my hand, 5 minutes before and couldn't find it. And
yep.
It's right back where it was supposed to be. So, hey, Justin, thanks, man. Yeah. I appreciate you.
I know that job well. Why don't you play another song for us?
Sure. This is a song about a dog.
Alrighty, horses and dogs. You heard it here. This is Live from Godfrey Daniels. I am Dina Hall, and my guest tonight is Ramin Shaygan.
I did not mean for you to wait around for me to come home. Don't you know, before I did go, well, you were already alone. Come back. Don't you know, before I did go, well, my bags was already packed.
For program support on WDIY, we thank Cedar Crest College, offering the low-residency Pan-European MFA in Creative Writing, allowing students to work towards the completion of a master's degree and the creation of a publishable work of literature. This summer's 15-day residency will be held at Trinity College in Dublin, Ireland, during the first 2 weeks of July. Learn more at cedarcrest.edu/MFA.
Well, if you're just tuning in, this is Live from God for Daniels. My name is Dina Hall, and my guest tonight is my good friend Ramin Shayegan. He is a certified luthier. He works at Martin Guitar. We're talking about how he came to be in this fabulous position in life. And, you know, not long ago I saw you were traveling not long ago, right?
I was traveling, yes.
And I saw a photograph of you playing a very unique instrument. Was this Cambodia, I believe?
Yes. So I take a more than casual interest in weird folk instruments. Now, what's weird to us here is, of course, what's totally normal to people in other parts of the world. So whether it's a Yoruba bata drum, you know, from, you know, Nigeria that ends up in Cuba and is hollowed out of a log, or a Mexican instrument that's made from a back of an armadillo, you know, there are all kinds of really crazy folk instruments. I was lucky recently to travel to Southeast Asia and got a lesson, a pretty cool, in-depth lesson with an expert in the Chapai Dong Vang, which is, I guess it means two-string long-neck guitar, or the equivalent of a guitar. And so if you go to look at some of the artwork on the temples, you'll see, you know, musicians in a lot of it. That just go all the way back to ancient Egypt, right? If you look at these religious art, you'll see musical instruments have a really prominent place there. So these instruments are ancient. It was very cool to see how basically the guitar, you know, which today we're building with, you know, titanium reinforcement rods and carbon fiber bridge plates and gold fret wire and liquid metal pins, you know, bridge pins, stuff that's sort of really amazingly advanced technology, that these instruments have evolved from a very pure, pragmatic place, and that the tonality of them is sort of like built on all these other things that came before. So in that sense, being able to play this instrument was like almost like time travel, you know, to not just to a different place, but to a different reality. Basically, this instrument has three strings, but only two of them are playing, and one string is actually used to retain the frets, which are movable. So they're just held in place with little dabs of wax on the underside.
Wow.
Yeah, it's so cool. And the necks on these things are like so long. You know, if you ever played like a ukulele and you felt like you were maybe chicken winged a little bit because you have to scooch up to hold it, this is like the total opposite. You're like holding out really far.
Oh, wow.
And the peg heads on these things are just intricate and very delicate. And I guess the longer they are and more decorative they are, the more of a fancy grade instrument you've got. So if you look at some of the videos of guys playing these, and there aren't a whole ton that you can really find, but if you look at the videos of these guys playing these instruments, they have super long, skinny peg heads, and the longer it is, the nicer it is. Now,
oh, wow.
From a construction standpoint, they're built with wood from the jackfruit tree.
Oh, so, I know what that is.
Yeah, it's incredible. So we've recently started exploring some woods at Martin that are, you know, fruit, from fruit trees. And it's a very sustainable way to build guitars, because the fruit trees have a sort of limited fruit-bearing life.
Uh-huh.
So if, like, take mango, for example. It's beautiful-looking wood. But a mango tree is really only good on a plantation for 15 or 20 years, and then they have to be torn down. So there's constant cycles of replanting and harvesting, and, you know, the trees have a sort of finite fruit-bearing lifespan. So if we can use this, it's truly a renewable resource. I mean, people are planting them with intent every day. Now, jackfruit grows everywhere out there. You kind of have to wonder if people don't get beamed in the head with falling jackfruits. sometimes
big,
in Cambodia.
They?
Oh, they're huge. Yeah, they're really, really cool. But basically, I noticed that the instrument that my teacher had, which was a nice chapai, was actually screwed together, that the top was bolted onto the back and sides, like nailed on, you know. And I asked him about this. I said, hey, you know, traditionally, is this like how they're built? You know, we use glue for most stuff. And he told me that the humidity in the monsoon season and the heat that they get really is not conducive to glues holding things together. And so, you know, it's kind of wild, but the geographical realities of, you know, where you live are, you know, manifest also in how the musical instruments are made. So I get such a kick out of that sort of thing. It's really pretty cool. And it's a challenge too, because you think, well, we make guitars that have to hold up in those environments as well.
Yeah.
And so those are challenges that we face. I think we do a pretty good job with some synthetic materials, but just to see how the sort of domestic instrument makers solve these problems is inspiring, and it's really wild.
And so my question is, what kind of case do they, let's say you were going to travel with one of those, do they have that type of apparatus?
Like a carrying case?
Yeah.
Oh, man. I imagine that they're just handmade, you know, fitted to the instrument by the maker.
You talked about the pegs, those. I could see that just becoming the thing that...
Well, there's no like one size fits all approach to that. So I imagine that they're made at the, you know, sort of concurrently with the instrument, that they would make a matching case that would,
and just sort of rectangular.
Well, they're really long and lithe, you know.
Yeah.
It's only got two strings, so you imagine the neck of the thing is really really narrow. It's almost
I know. I'm looking at that picture. It looked like it was 6 feet long.
And their scale, their musical scale, is pentatonic too, which is really, really cool, because that's sort of the root of all blues music. So, you know, when you hear these guys playing these things, you think you can actually, you know, sort of a projection, but you can hear, you know, Mississippi John Hurt, and you can hear Muddy Waters in there, and you can hear all this stuff that it has to do with the tonality of their instruments. So, like, for example, if I wanted to make my guitar sound a little bit like a chapai, I could detune it like this. It's really cool, and that, you know, they can achieve these different sort of intertones, these microtones, just by pushing a little bit harder on the string, because the frets are so tall that you can change the pitch just by how hard you press down. So it's really cool. It's almost like you see this in heavy metal, you know, a scalloped fretboard, which is just a, you know, on a Stratocaster, it's a hideous thing. But on a traditional folk instrument like that, it's amazing. It's like a sitar.
Yeah.
Really, really
cool.
That's
what it reminded me of when I was thinking about it. So part of your trip also, not to get away from the instrument itself, but part of your trip, you really did, to Southeast Asia, to Cambodia, you really did experience a lot of the culture. You immerse yourself in the culture, right? This is...
Well, I was lucky to have a traveling companion and someone that I could sort of lean on to help me interpret the culture, because there's a lot of stuff that's really, you know, totally foreign. But it was really cool. Religion is pretty central, I think, in a lot of people's lives, as evidenced by the temples that are really, you know, ubiquitous. And I wonder, you know, if someone were visiting the United States and they'd see a church on every, you know, a church on every street in Bethlehem, there are so many congregations, if they might draw the same conclusions about our culture. But the one thing we saw that really stuck with me was this temple in a cave. And if you didn't know that it was there, or if there wasn't a pretty steady stream of local Cambodian tourists going there, it would have been possible to miss it. Especially once we wandered back out, it was almost there was a point where we weren't sure how to get back in, you know, if we had to go around the whole outside. But you go in this cave entrance, there's incense wafting, and there are, you know, little kids sort of asking to guide you around, and, you know, beggars and monks and people looking, you know, making offerings and looking for offerings and just chanting in, you know, in unison, sort of quietly alone, but also very much together with all these other people. And you walk and you wander through the caves and just sort of scattered throughout them. There's some standing water in some areas, and you know, you sort of walk along these truck tires to get in there, and there'll be like a gilded statue of the Buddha. Or you'll keep going, and the cave just opens up into this this clearing, 200 foot tall, sheer cliff walls on all sides. And then in the center of it, just this beautiful space. I had never seen anything like that before. That was really, really cool. Sort of a hidden mm-hmm. a hidden temple. And we were some of the only Western tourists there. It was sort of a big holiday weekend in Phnom Penh, in the capital. So people were, I think, eager to leave the city. People who live in the city wanted to get out to the countryside. And people who are living out in the countryside wanted to get into the city, where there's this big hubbub, crazy hustle bustle, and boat races. And so it was really cool to see Cambodian people actually enjoying this as well. It made me feel less like a tourist in some ways, because you know, people who live here are blown away by this, and they come. This is a destination even for people who haven't traveled so far.
Mm-hmm.
It was really wild. It was very cool. So Cambodia is also a real wake up call in terms of traffic and how vehicles move. We did rent some motorcycles mopeds at one point, my friend and I, and I had to sort of follow her lead, and it was a real, for me, it was a real leap to hit the throttle, because everything you think you know about how to operate a motor vehicle will get you killed. It's like, you know, be aggressive, but for God's sake, don't be indecisive. You just have to go for it. And that took some getting used to. Even walking was a little bit scary.
So listen on to that, stay to the right side of the sidewalk.
In the cities, there's sidewalk.
Assuming there's a sidewalk, yes.
But, you know, at any point, the sidewalk could be occupied by construction or garbage or street vendors, impromptu, you know, stalls, markets, stray dogs that you don't want to get too close to, and some stray dogs that you really wish you could just hug them and take them home. Really, just a totally different philosophy around how to get through the day-to-day comings and goings, and sort of like a Jesus take the wheel. It seems cavalier, right? Mm-hmm. You know, when you're there and you think, oh man, like, how do people just risk so much? But if you're used to it, it doesn't seem so crazy. There is a flow. It looks like chaos, but it's really maybe not.
Yeah.
It was really interesting.
All right. I'm going to take a quick break. I'm going to get some messages on here, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Tune up your week with a great variety of jazz music on WDIY. Monday through Friday nights from 9 to 11 offers many choices from the world of jazz, featuring traditional to modern styles, plus Swing Sunday at 5 p.m. and improvisational jazz on the bridge Sunday nights at 10 p.m. Listen for new releases, interviews with artists, and information on upcoming performances right here on WDIY.
Oh wow, we're just singing here while we were listening to that. My guest tonight is Ramin Shayegan. He's a certified luthier. He works at Martin Guitar, and he is here talking about. Right now, we're talking about his recent trip to Cambodia, and I think before we get on to play another song, I just want to hear. I think you had a little bit of a harrowing experience on your return home. Is this true?
Yeah, I did, and it's funny because I had such a nice time there that it's weird. That's sort of my lingering souvenir. Aside from this, the pepper, I brought back some pepper from a pepper farm. That I've been cooking with at home, and it's just amazing. I didn't know this. There's a lot I didn't know. It's not I don't know. But Cambodia is famous for its pepper. And so at some point during this trip, I must have been bitten by a mosquito because a few days into the trip, I started to feel this like headache. I had a glass of wine. I had this headache, terrible headache behind my eyeballs. I thought, oh, it's just sun poisoning or something. I've been out on the moped with no sunscreen, like a very smart boy. Then the next day, I realized I had a really rocking fever. And then the next day, which is my last day, I realized I had little red spots on my hands and feet. And at this point, I thought, oh, man, like something is probably not good here. So my friend put me on a tuk-tuk and sent me back to the airport. And I was standing in line and just feeling really ill. And took the four-hour flight from Phnom Penh to Guangzhou, China, where I had a six-hour layover. But I sat down on the plane and in Phnom Penh, and I woke up in Guangzhou, and I was the only person left on the plane, which meant that I had slept through takeoff, food service, 4 hours of flight, and then landing, and then disembarkation.
So that's a nap.
Oh, you're not kidding. I mean, it was wow. like a light bulb, and so I start walking through the airport, and usually I'm pretty aware of like security measures or, you know, whatever is going on there, especially in China. You sort of, you know, you're not. I don't want to sound like paranoid, but it's you know that things happen, and I was just really feeling sick, so I was walking along, and this woman came up to me and stopped me. She said, "Sir, are you feeling all right?" And I'm like, yes." Like I didn't want to be detained in China. And she said, "Walk back." And I look, and she's got an iPad, which turns out that the turnstile I had just walked through was an infrared temperature sensor. So people are walking through these turnstiles, and they're cool blue, and then there's me walking through, like, white hot. Like, I have lit this thing, like a Roman candle, okay? Like a Christmas tree. And she seemed to think that the machine must be broken, so she had me walk through a different one. And then at this point, another lady comes along, and she says, "Sir, your temperature is 41 degrees. And I'm doing the mental math, 41 degrees. That's like 105 plus.
Yikes.
So I'm walking around like patient zero in some kind of apocalyptic zombie movie, you know, wondering if I should do a runner, trying to escape. And they walk me through the bowels of this giant airport into a little room called the Fever Investigation Room. It says it in English on a plaque above the door.
It says it in English.
Fever Investigation.
Oh, right.
And they've got this metal bench in there. And you're like, oh, man. And she slapped a document down in front of me and said, "You sign this." I read it. It is like burned into my brain.
You're 105 fever, and you were still able to.
Oh well, so I'm reading this thing, and the words are swimming on the page, and it says, "You have brought communicable disease into the People's Republic of China. You are responsible for the legal consequences. If you do not comply with our requests, you will begin a fixed 3-year term of imprisonment." And I read this, and I thought, "Oh my God, I'm."
And you're alone now, right?
Oh, totally alone. Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Didn't know Wi-Fi, you know, no Facebook Messenger because it's blocked over there. No Gmail, it's blocked out there. And so, so at this point, I signed it, and I thought, okay, God bless me, I'll be out when I'm 32 years old, cling to some happy memories. And they start drawing blood. And they took, you know, vial after vial. And then the lady hands me my passport or holds it out to me and says, "Okay, you can go now, but only if you're fine." I said, "I'm fine." I grabbed my passport. I said, I'm fine. I took 3 steps and I went down like a sack of potatoes. Just fell to the ground. And I heard, I experienced this like time dilation. I heard the entire chorus of Comfortably Numb in the time it took for me to realize that I was going down and hitting the floor. So at this point, I realized they just wanted to get me the heck out of China and just to not be their problem, whether I was going to die or whatever, that they just didn't want to deal with it. So I sat there and I said, I'll wait, you know, for the results. She said, well, you'll wait? I said, yeah, I'll wait. How long? She said, 15 minutes or 2 days? I said, 15 minutes, please.
And you had an option?
Yeah. She gave me the option. She said, 2 days or 15 minutes. So I sat there for 15 minutes, and they ran these instant blood tests. And it's like going through the panel one by one of, like, worst-case scenario. Malaria. You don't have malaria. Oh, I don't have malaria. Thank goodness. The next one, dengue. You have dengue. Oh, my goodness. So I wandered through the airport a little bit more, ended up at a first aid station, and the doctor there didn't understand what I was trying to say. And so I gave her a dollar, and she said, this will help your fever, and gave me a little blister pack of four pills. And I took one immediately for, you know, hoping for some relief. And then I would say I Googled it, but I Binged it because Google's blocked
no
in
Google.
China. So I Binged it up. And it turns out it was aspirin and caffeine, which are like the two worst possible things that you could take if you have dengue fever, because the aspirin's a blood thinner, and so it can become a hemorrhagic fever, you know, bleeding from the eyeballs. And the caffeine is just like really not what you want. So I sort of white-knuckled it through the 18-hour flight back, and my folks took me straight to the hospital and got some bags of fluid put back in, and
wow.
Went back to work the next day. I was
and
so
you
excited.
Look fabulous.
I feel great.
Yeah. You just look great. Wow. All right, then. See, I knew there was a fantastic story just boiling to come up to the surface here tonight.
That's probably the third or fourth time that I've told that story. And every time I think, my goodness, that was, I'm in a club. I'm in like the dengue fever club.
Yeah.
There is, incidentally, a great Cambodian, almost like psychedelic rock band called Dengue Fever. The singer is Cambodian, and I think the rest of the band members might be American.
Mm-hmm.
But the music is just like ethereal and wild and super cool. So I strongly suggest that people check that out. Do you want to do a song, Dina?
Yes, I do. Before we do the song, because this is going to take us to the sort of the close of what we're doing here, I want to remind everyone that Ramin Shaygan is a songwriter. He is a performer as well. What you got anything coming up soon?
Yes. So I am really lucky to have a great musical collaborator in my friend Mark Spellman, who's my good friend and neighbor, and we have a little thing called Ram Trout. So you can find us on Facebook or on the Google or the Bing at Ram Trout, RamTrout. And all of our upcoming dates are listed there. And I may be joining Mark's group Without George in the next few weeks.
Called
Without George. And when Mark leaves, I think we're going to continue both of those projects and call it Without Trout. And
where's he going?
He's going back to Ireland.
He's
Irish.
Yes.
Hey, Mark, if you're out there.
Yes.
Love you, buddy.
Okay. What would you like to play?
Well, I've got a couple ideas, but there's a song that you and I have sung together a couple times that I really like.
Okay.
You want to? I'll be Robert Plant minus the bulge, and you'll be Dina Hall.
I'll be Dina Hall. I really can't be anyone else.
Allison.
I tried being Alanis Morissette once, and it just went horribly wrong. What would you like to play? Well, just play. Let's not even
Here's
tell them
one.
What it
I
is.
I think it's by Roland Sally. Falling just like amber, colors red and gold. They set us on fire, burning just like moonbeams in our eyes. Somebody said they saw me swinging the world by the tail, bouncing over a white cloud, killing the blues. Well, I am guilty of something I hope you never do, because there is nothing any sadder than losing yourself in love. Somebody said they saw me swinging the world by the tail, bouncing over a white cloud, killing the blues. Just to leave you, to go out on my own and get what I really need. You want me to find what I've already had. Somebody said they saw me swinging the by the tail, bouncing over a white cloud, killing the blues. Somebody said they saw me swinging the world by the tail, bouncing over a white cloud, killing the blues.
Ramin Shayan, my guest tonight on Live from God for Daniels. Thank you so much, my friend.
Thank you, Dina. It's been a real pleasure to be here, and I only wish we had more time.
We'll be back another time. Thank you so much for tuning in, folks, and we've got some music coming up in just a moment.